Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club, and also our radio and online audiences. And you can always reach us at www.commonwealthclub.org. And it's my pleasure tonight to introduce Herschel Cobb, who wrote a book, Heart of a Tiger, Growing Up with My Grandfather. His grandfather is the famous baseball player Ty Cobb. It's just an outstanding memoir about his childhood, his life, and I just want to say one thing about it before. It's very rare that someone can write with that much compassion about that much pain. Thank you very much for coming. Herschel Cobb.
Thank you, George. Well, first of all, I want to thank George for arranging this, and I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for having me and inviting me. This is really quite an honor. And I want to thank all of you for being interested enough to attend here this evening. First thing that I have said to many people is that I didn't write a baseball book. There are lots of those. There's lots of statistics. What I wrote turned out to be a story of a grandson and a grandfather. And I got started kind of accidentally. My wife, who is here, and I have two children, and our daughter Madeline was, 12 or 13 years old, and one night we were looking at pictures of her as a little girl, just 4 and 5 and 6 years old, and she was playing, and she turned to me after we were done, and she said, "Daddy, tell me a story about when you were a little boy." Well, my face turned red, I kind of perspired, and I started to think, and there was not one story that I could remember with my father or my mother that I could actually tell her about. They were filled, my stories of my early childhood were constantly filled with terrorizing, scary pictures and images. And for a long time, 6, 7 years old, that was the norm. But being creative and on the spot, I thought of a very funny story of one time being at Lake Tahoe with my grandfather when I was in my teenage years, and it was a funny story. Yeah, I'll tell you the story. It's fully related in the book, but it was after we had been going to Tahoe for a few years, and we were up there, and there was an awful, awful heat wave. And if you've ever been to Lake Tahoe and they have a heat wave, the air is very still and there's no movement, and even 90, 93 or 4 degrees is just suffocating. And my grandfather didn't like the heat, but he loved Lake Tahoe. That's where he said he always got his best sleep, but usually it's cool in the evenings and warm in the day. But anyway, so it had been hot for a couple of days and everybody was perspiring, and you just walk around to get the air movement. And about the fourth day of this heat wave, Granddaddy was in one of his favorite chairs trying to take a nap, and you could tell his forearms were wet on the side of the chairs, which were wooden, and he was lying there jerking around a little bit in the heat trying to take an afternoon nap, when all of a sudden he jumped up and opened his arms and waved around and started yelling at us. We were up there, and he says, "Herschel, Susan, quick," that's my sister, "quick, quick, grab all the sheets off all the beds, quick, quick, follow me." And I honestly thought he had a stroke and the heat got to him. And he kept yelling. And he went to his bedroom and he just took the white sheets and he yanked them off the bed. And he ran across the cabin, which wasn't too large. And he put them into this shower. And it was a secondary shower. It was one of those showers that you have in a cabin. It was metal. And you could hear the water running and pounding against the metal. And the sheets were getting soaked. And he yelled, "Quick, more sheets, more sheets, more sheets." And he says, I looked at Susan, he says, "Oh, I don't know what's going to happen here." Anyway, so he got all these sheets soaking wet, and he picks up a bundle of sheets. He says, "Here, take these, follow me, and get me the stepladder." So I got him the stepladder, and he went immediately to one of the open windows and the open doors and started tacking up these wet sheets. And we're going around, I look back, and there I see the air billowing the sheet in toward the cabin. And he had detected this little zephyr breeze coming up and knew exactly how to cool down his cabin. But he kept going, so he had sheets everywhere. It looked like a kid's ghost cottage. And finally he turned around and he's cooling himself off in this breeze that started building up. And he turned to us, he says, "Well, how do you kids like Granddaddy's air conditioning system?" he liked that kind of a joke, and my daughter loved it. She wanted to know everything about his cabin. Well, that's a chapter in the book, part of a trip up to Lake Tahoe with him. But early on, my life was dominated by this other force. Started writing these stories down and had quite a few of them because I really liked them, and I was always kind of held on to them. It was kind of how I held on to my grandfather. I didn't share them much in college, particularly in college, you're by yourself, and people wouldn't understand at 18 and 20 anyway. But Madeline was interested. My wife said, "Why don't you write some of these down?" So I got a notebook, and I had a pretty good memory of these things, and so I made a few notes, and they were pretty funny, and the kids wanted to know about them. And after I'd written a few of the stories, and I started remembering how it felt, and I also remembered what it was like with my parents, and I knew that if I wrote that part of a book, that in order to make it a book that people might see the point of, I'd have to write the other part. And so eventually I got started in writing about early childhood memories. The first memory that I have of my grandfather was in Twin Falls, Idaho in 1949, and he came to visit us at our home there with the idea of going duck hunting on the Snake River with my father. Now, I was going to be 7 years old, and I wasn't very big. I was 47 inches tall and weighed about 58 pounds. In my research of family stuff, I found my first grade report card, so I could be accurate there. But anyway, my father was a bully, and he had some idea that I should learn how to hunt and shoot a shotgun, so I was going to go with him on this duck hunting trip on the Snake. So we had a Labrador. It was a wonderful dog, Babe, female lab. And so we had dinner at our house, which was an awful, awful dinner. My mother was bristling because my grandfather saw her kind of for who she was, and she knew that, and she didn't dare say anything. But she and my father were stuck together in an awful marriage, and they had their individual problems over that alcohol and just angry as hell at each other. But anyway, we went on this duck hunting trip, and we settled in this island, and it was toward the end of the trip that I was just praying that we would just finish up and go back home. And the ducks stopped flying down the Snake River, and the hunt was over, and my father yelled at me and ordered me to pick up some tin cans and a milk bottle and set them on a tree. And my grandfather was at the other end of this little island, and my father put a 20-gauge shotgun in my shoulder, held it there, and just told me I was going to learn how to be a man and shoot a shotgun, and scared me because I could barely lift this weapon. And so he was very intense about it, and it was either get a whipping on the spot or try and hit this tin can. And so I held the gun and eventually pulled the trigger, and the sound seared my ears. The kick of the shotgun knocked me on my back end. I landed on my hands and had pebbles and cuts in my hands. And my father caught the gun and grabbed me and said, "We're going to do this again until you learn how to do it." So I was there again, aiming, waiting for this terrorizing blast to rip my shoulder apart again. My father bearing down on me, where I saw this wrist and hand come in and grab this shotgun, and my father's hand that was holding me and just start squeezing. And it was my grandfather. And it wasn't going to happen again. And I knew. I could see his muscles quivering, and his hand was big and strong. And he whispered in my father's ear, says, "Stop it. You're not going to hurt the boy anymore." And he just kept squeezing. And I could feel my father's hand let go. I could see the sweat coming out of his forehead, his eyes turning red. And my grandfather just holding this gun, repeating, "Stop it. We're going home right now." And that's what we did. My father bolted away, expletives, And my grandfather took the shotgun, told me to get my stuff, meet him back here. We're headed back to the cabin, back home. So it exhausted me. I climbed in the back seat, put my head on Babe, and kind of passed out from fright and cold. And we got home, and I woke up alone in my bed with a quilt over me and looked around and out the window, and nobody was there. My father and mother were gone. My grandfather was gone. And I just lay there and started thinking about my life. I was 7 years old, and every time I turned around, I had my father to contend with. So I wrote about that. that took quite a few evenings, and Lynn will attest that there were many evenings I spent a couple of hours writing and came to the kitchen and said, where's that bottle of scotch? I got to wash some of this away. And that kind of worked, but it kind of stayed with me. But anyway, eventually those first two chapters got written. A third chapter got written. When I was 8 years old, my father died. He was 33 years old, and he died of a massive heart attack. He was a huge guy, 300 pounds or a little more, 6 feet one, towering, strong, and unhappy. And I've always attributed it to that there was a soul that just wanted off the planet. And at the age of 33, he had a heart attack and died on the parking lot coming out of a place of business in Paso Robles, California. So at that time, we were living in Santa Maria, California, and I came home from school. Our maid Ayako was there with my sister, and the house was quiet. I crept in, and I looked at them, and I thought something terrible had happened, and Ayako called me over and said, "Herschel, your father died this morning." And I just stopped, and she wanted to give me a hug, and I didn't want a hug. And I backed up, went through the house, got my bicycle on the front lawn, started pedaling around Santa Maria, relieved and happy. And then I got a couple of blocks into town, and I realized, you know, my dad was dead, and I had kind of wanted that, so I would live. And that happened, but then it hit me just like, wow, I'm never going to have a dad anymore. Not the dad I wanted. Well, as things were, my mom didn't have much use for her kids, and she'd ship us to Palo Alto, California every summer to be with my grandmother, who was happy to have us. And interestingly enough, my grandmother made sure that we saw granddaddy 2 to 3 weeks a year. So it started about the age of 10. Well, one interlude is that in 1952, my uncle Ty Jr., Ty's first son, developed a brain tumor in the back of his skull that was one of those that just grows fast and is inoperable. And he came from Florida, where his home was, to Menlo Park to be with his mom, where he was going to die. When we arrived that summer, Grandma looked very, very tired, and she picked us up at the train depot in Palo Alto, took us to her home, and immediately I saw the reason why she was so despondent and tired and looked exhausted. And Uncle Ty was in a wheelchair, just grabbing onto the sides and barely able to talk. And by the end of the summer, he could not remember his own children's names. So Ty Cobb had lost two of his sons in the course of about 15 months. And that really devastated him, because his relationship with his sons was never good, and you could say it was poor. He had been successful. They had been the beneficiaries of a lot of the trappings of his success, and there'd never been a bonding. And now both boys were gone, and they'd had their problems with their father, Ty Sr., Ty Jr., my father. And I could tell on our visits to Granddaddy that summer that he was devastated. The first visit was just awful. He had a very nice home in Atherton, Spanish-style home, lots of windows and stuff. And Grandma took us over to visit, and he wanted us to come and visit him, and he was in his favorite chair. And we walked in, and he had all the curtains drawn. The living room was dark. And he had a light on next to him where he had been reading or just sitting there. And I walked in, and First of all, I saw he had two mismatched socks. His shoelaces weren't tied. I went to hug him, and he had whiskers. He had missed shaving. He had a shirt that was dirty, and he was crumpled in a seat like a beaten guy. And it was, well, for me, it was just scary because he was my only hope. I'd had a taste of it on the Snake River, and I saw this man in front of me who I hadn't seen for 2 years, and I thought, wow, Granddaddy's really in bad shape. I'm, you know, 9 years old. Turns out my sister was there. She had been dressed up in a nice little spring dress, blonde, beautiful complexion, 2 years older than me. And we're talking to Granddaddy, and he's telling us he's had a hard time and it's good to see us. And my sister just looks at the situation and looks around and walks up to him, grabs him, gives him this huge hug, and says in his ear, loud enough for everybody to hear, although quietly, she says, "Granddaddy, it's okay, just you wait. Everything's going to be okay." She just had the biggest heart. Me and my brother benefited from that all of our lives. She really essentially took care of us, and we grew up with her. So I wrote about that, and I remembered all these things. I remember that afternoon. I remember it was a short visit. We were there 20, 25 minutes. It was just too much for kids to take, but he had wanted to see us, and he said, "I'll see you again in a few days." And next time we saw him at his house in Atherton, the windows were open, there was a breeze blowing through, the light was shining, and he was clean, he had fresh shirt, matching socks, and things started to change. We saw him a few times that summer, and the last visit he said, "Well, I hope next year we're able to do something together." I had no idea what he meant, but I'd been used all my life to my parents basically pulling the rug out from under me in one way or the other, promising things and not doing them, or purposely doing something, that making suggestions that were bad for me. But anyway, the next summer begins the times that we went to Lake Tahoe or Atherton with my grandfather. He had a wonderful cabin at Cave Rock. I don't know if any of you know where Glenbrook is. Cave Rock is maybe 8 miles on the Nevada side up from South Shore. You go through Cave Rock, and the road down to his house isn't marked, but there's a turn there, and you start down, and you say, wow. And there's a little colony of homes there, and he had a cabin there. Not a big cabin. He had a living room kind of about the size of this room, and then you have a kitchen, a bedroom, and a bedroom, and a bedroom, and a nice deck overlooking Lake Tahoe. Really nice. And we were there that summer. We played in the water, played around Lake Tahoe, enjoyed his company, got to see Glenbrook, got to ride in his Chris Craft, and that in itself brought back many, many, many memories that were scary for me, because I'd ridden in boats with my father on the Snake River, and they were always scary. I ended up being thrown in the water or tossed out of the boat or going so fast and without a life jacket on or any place to hang on. Nothing bad happened, and it was transformational because Granddaddy made sure that each of us felt secure. So that's in the book, that entire chapter, how it started and some of the fun things. He took a real liking to my brother, who was plump and loved to eat, my sister, who was curly red hair, and me, and it was fun. So I started, when I wrote down all of these stories, I tried to pick one or two from each year that we visited with him at Lake Tahoe or in Atherton, and many of them, in fact, every time that we were together, I kind of learned something about how people are, and some of it was funny, and some of it stayed with me, and I enjoyed it. For a few years of doing this, I didn't quite realize who he was in the world of baseball. He was my grandfather. That was really important to me. My mother and he didn't get along. When my father died, she wanted money from my grandfather. He didn't like her at all. She drank quite a lot. Her normal drinking amount was maybe a quart of Old Crow every night. And she used to have a tumbler or two before bed, which was milk and bourbon. And That just went on, and a lot of stuff that today we'd say are dysfunctional. But when I was writing, I realized that other kids probably have grandparents who helped them out, and the book might appeal to them. Of course, the book was all done at that time. But in any event, when I was 10, 11, and 12, I didn't quite realize who my grandfather was in the world of baseball. When I was 13, I went out for Middle League Baseball, and it was just terrible. I was a pretty good athlete, and I remember getting a couple of hits, but the heckling and the expectations were just over the top, and I didn't know why. Dads were yelling at me to get a hit and use my spikes and slide into guys, and guys were yelling me to say, run, steal second, steal third, and spike this guy. And when I left Santa Maria that summer, went up to visit with my grandmother, and Grandma took us over to Granddaddy's house the first time, I had a head of steam going. I wanted to know what in the world he had done, because I was sure he had done something terrible and very, very noteworthy, because his name had been put in my face many, many times. So I went into the house, and I sat right in front of him, and I said, I want to know what you did. And he said, well, okay, sit down. And we had kind of a routine. He was very interested in character, and so the routine was something like we'd come in and visit him, and he'd say, Herschel, would you like a drink? Would you like a beer or something? Now, I'm 10 or 11 or 12 years old. I'd say no. He said, well, would you like a cigarette? And he said, no, granted, I don't smoke. I'm playing sports. He says, well, and then we go through all the books I've read that year and what characters I liked, and he was an avid reader, and he'd always have three or four books going. And so this was no different. I came in, I wanted to know who he was and what he had done. And he sat me down, and Susan and my brother Kit were there, and it was sit down and tell me about how your year went. And I started to blurb about my Little League Baseball. He said, be quiet about that. Tell me about your books. You want a beer? We went through our routine. And he knew something was going on, and he asked Susan to take my brother Kit to the kitchen and get some ice cream, that he had some things to talk to me about. And he asked, How was your baseball? And so I started to tell him, and he seemed to have figured this out. He said, oh, okay, I understand. So he said, why don't you come and help me? And so he took my hand, and we went into his office. He didn't say anything. He said, I want you to help me. I have all of these letters, and I want you to help me with them. So we're in his office, and I'm looking around, and there are autographed pictures of Tris Speaker and Babe Ruth and Honus Wagner. There are old baseball bats in the corner, gloves, spike shoes, and he sits me down in this swivel chair, and right in front of me is this large poster, Granddaddy's face smiling in this oval center, and up at the top it has World's Greatest Hitter, 4,191 hits, Greatest Base Stealer, 900 and some total bases, and all of these side pictures were records of his in baseball. And at the same time he says, Hurst, I've got these letters from these youngsters who want a signed picture or a baseball. I want you to help me. I'm going to sign the baseball. I'll read you the letter. I'm going to sign the baseball, and your job is to put it in the box and make the letters big enough so the post guy doesn't make a mistake of mailing it back to him. So he read a letter and signed it to this kid and gave me the thing. So I described that in some detail in my book. So we did that for maybe an hour. Never once did he say anything much about baseball. It was just everything in that office said everything. And after about an hour, he said, well, I think that's about enough. Let's go find some ice cream. And that was it. And he left the room, and I spent a few minutes looking at all of these pictures. And he had a 55-gallon drum next to his desk filled with Major League Baseballs. And any kid who wrote wanted a baseball, he reached in there, got a baseball, packaged it, and sent it to him. And he had action pictures of him, reproductions, or a picture. And he'd say something personal if the kid asked for it. The letters were very touching. I mean, I remember him, and I could describe him, but I've described him in the book. So he left, and, you know, the thought really struck me. I said, wow, I want my granddad. Everything in that room was him, gave him bragging rights of some kind. And he'd never said it in the room. And my fear was I was going to lose my grandfather, and he was going to become Ty Cobb. My fear was unfounded. He never did. We went out and we had ice cream, and we had a very fun time on the front lawn of his house. He was going to show me how to bat, and he did. And it's a very charming remembrance that I have. We went through taking turns batting, and he was showing us how to spread our hands so we'd have more control over the bat. And we only found three gloves that were usable in his office, so he was barehanded, and he managed to catch a line drive in his bare hand and shake it, and that hurt and all that. But we got through the batting stuff, and the funny part was is that he said, Hirsch, do you know how to slide? Now, you got to realize he's in his early 60s at this point. He's carrying a little extra weight, and he's got his gabardine slacks on, his nice shoes and nice shirt, and he takes one of the mitts he's going to use for a base, and he backs up about 60 feet in his front lawn, and he's getting ready. He takes his shoes off, rolls up his cuffs in his stocking feet, and he's looking at it and says, this is how you get ready. And right then, his nurse comes out of the front door, and she yells at the top of her lungs, she says, Mr. Cobb, what are you doing? And she doesn't want to see him try this. And finally, he says, Mr. Cobb, come quickly, it's the telephone. And so I guess he senses that maybe he shouldn't do this. He turns and went inside. So I never got to see him show us the slide. But I tried to pick something that was meaningful to me and might evoke something that was helpful and fun for other people who've had grandparents, or maybe if they're grandparents, they have grandchildren. And that's what the chapters are about. After that, we regularly went to Lake Tahoe. One of his favorite places to dine was a place called the North Shore Club. And the North Shore Club was what in those days was called a dinner house, but they had a lot of gambling. It was in Nevada. And on one occasion, one summer, we're going to go there for dinner, and he warned me in the morning that we're going to go to the North Shore Club and to make sure that I was up at the house from the lake at a certain time so we'd be ready to go. Just so you get an idea physically how it was, is his house overlooks Lake Tahoe. It's quite a number of steps down to the lake, and then he had there was a large cove. His house was, I think he had about 2.75 acres there, and part of that's beach, and then you have a little community of houses that shared the other half of this cove beach. So I had a cove to row around in with a wooden boat that he had bought me, and I had a ball. I mean, I'd just chase fish and jump off the docks and all that kind of stuff. Well, on this particular day, he had told me that we were going to the North Shore Club, and I came up from the beach and came into the house, and he was asleep in his chair, and there was a lot of noise coming from the radio. He tried to find a ball game, and he fell asleep. And I turned the radio off, and he's asleep, but I noticed on the octagonal table in front of him, it's kind of a little coffee table, there were three envelopes, and they were stuffed with money. And I crept around, didn't want to disturb Granddaddy. I wanted to know what all the money was about. And they were all $100 bills in these three number 10 size envelopes. And I checked it out, and they were fat. He was asleep, and I'm wandering around, standing there, and they had an electrical storm at the other end of the lake, and you get this huge black cone at Lake Tahoe, and then a lightning will come through, and you have this big blast. And one of those big lightning blasts occurred, and he woke up and startled and looked over and saw the envelopes. I was watching him, and I didn't want to ask him about it, but I knew we were going to the North Shore Club, and he immediately told me to go get some lunch and have a sandwich and make sure I rested for a while. We were going to go out. Well, we did, and I watched him come out from his bedroom. He had a sport coat on and take the envelopes and put them in his pocket, and we went to the North Shore Club. And it was really interesting because we arrived at the North Shore Club, and everybody knew him, and everybody knew him. He was accosted at the front door by a guy who wanted to pick a fight, kind of avoided that in a neat way, which I described. And then the maitre d', who showed us to a very nice table, and there were a lot of dancing girls and guys on the stage, all live entertainment, and it was really quite captivating. I was getting to be 14, and it looked pretty good, but I knew that Granddaddy came to came to the North Shore Club with something in mind, and as soon as he sat us at this table, he disappeared through a door into the gambling room, and I just got up and followed him. I wanted to know what he was up to. And I walked into the gambling room. It was filled with smoke, and you could hear all the slot machines and all that kind of stuff going on. And I stationed myself. I knew I didn't belong there, and I stationed myself up against the wall and was looking around and kind of spotted Granddaddy, and immediately in front of me was one of the guys looking to see that kids don't come into the gambling room. He had on a tuxedo and slick back hair and black hair. And so I said, he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm waiting for that man over there." And he looked over, he looked through the smoke. He says, "Cobb? Cobb?" He says, "Yeah, that's my grandfather." He says, "Cobb is your grandfather?" And I said, yeah, "I'm waiting for my granddaddy. He'll be right here." He said, "Well, if Cobb's your grandfather, you stay right here. But when I come back here, young man, you be gone." So I just melted into the wall waiting for Granddaddy, but I watched him. He was talking to a man who was sitting in a straight back chair, and I could see from that distance that the guy's sleeves were ragged, his shoes were scuffy, but they obviously knew each other. They were waving at each other and talking and gesticulating, and they went on for 5 or 7 minutes, and finally Granddaddy reached into his pocket, took one of these envelopes, and stuffed it in this guy's jacket pocket. And this guy just stood right up and gave him a big hug. And I knew right away it was a friend of his. And it was. It was an old ball player who had fallen on hard times or didn't save his money. And I learned later that Granddaddy helped this guy out every year. And they met at Lake Tahoe at the North Shore Club. I described this in the book because there was another gentleman that, as Granddaddy found me, asked me what I was doing in the gambling room. I thought I was in big trouble, but I really wasn't. We started to go back to our table, and he saw another friend that had just come in the front door. We headed in that direction and watched something very similar. We talked to this fellow, introduced me to him. He was an old ball player friend of his, and this fellow didn't have money either, needed help, and another envelope came out, stuffed into this guy's hand, and the guy looked like he was going to cry and turned and left the North Shore Club. Well, the generosity that I saw throughout my experience with my grandfather went here, like at the North Shore Club, on our way to Tahoe on a trip through the Lodi area where you had fruit stands and things like that. But what I related it to later in my life when I read about him is that, you know, when he was a player manager, he used to regularly get his team members into his office and try and get him and encourage them to invest in the stock market and to save their money so they would have money when they left the game of baseball. Because one of his objectives, as he told me, was that he never wanted to be dependent upon the Tiger organization for his livelihood. So he started investing right away. He wanted his own money. So, I go into that because one summer, many of you know that he invested in Coca-Cola, but one summer, we were getting ready to have dinner, and he asked me to clear off his dining room table, which was a large oak table, kind of rough hewn, and lots of papers on it. So I went to sort them out, and there was a check there on the table that was sticking out of an envelope. So I got the check, and I took it over to him, and I said, "You don't want this thrown away, do you, Granddaddy?" He said, he looked at it, he says, "Oh, that's where that's been." And it was his dividend check from the Coca-Cola company. It was over $83,000 as a quarterly dividend. He said, "I got to put that in the bank." So he folded it up, put it in his pocket. And so he asked me if I knew what a stock was and how to invest and what these companies did, because when he was a ball player, the fellows who ran these companies, just like today, wanted to hang out with ball players. Anyway, he got good advice. So I talk about that a little bit, and his generosity extended to a lot of the fruit farmers in the Lodi area. One summer we took a road trip, and every place we stopped, he bought a flat of strawberries or peaches. We had a lot of peaches, a lot of tomatoes. But he paid for these $2 flats or dollar flats in a $100 bill. And this trip, he did this once, and then the second stand that we stopped at, he paid this guy a $100 bill. I said, "Granddaddy, that's $100 you just gave me." And he was really matter of fact. He says, "Hirsch, you know, I've told you before, when I was with a plow behind a mule, in Narrows, Georgia with that Negro boy, we didn't have a nickel in our pocket. We had nothing extra, no jingle. These fellows work hard all day in the same dust that I know I worked in, and I wanted to have something extra, some jingle in their pocket. So we ended up with all these flats and paid for them all with a $100 bill. And it was kind of neat to have a grandfather who could reach into his pocket and do that. I was learning. We just really take care of people. That trip had a lot of fun and interesting incidents to it, and I described those in my book. And so that's the kind of the way that I progressed. I felt very lucky. I reached the age where I was applying to college, and somehow found out I had good grades. And my mother was in no way going to send me away to school. She said, no, you can go to the local JC. I'm not going to pay for your college. It's 1961 in the summer, July 17. And it came along, and the radio announcer had announced that baseball great Ty Cobb had died, and they played Take Me Out to a Ball Game a couple of times. I thought, oh my God, I'm sunk. I didn't get along with my mother, and I knew I was sunk. Next day, my sister called me to the phone and said, it's a phone call for you. There's a gentleman by the name of Edward Brannon with the Trust Company of Georgia. I said, Herschel, I just talked to your sister and I want to talk to you. He said, your grandfather left a will and he's left some money for you to go to school on if you want. Wow. I didn't know what to do. I was so thankful. He had taken really good care of me. I was able to go to the college of my choice. Had money left over to go to graduate school. And there were many times when I went to college, people asked me about my famous grandfather and baseball and spikes and being aggressive, hard to deal with. And the man that I knew had saved me over and over again and left with me, you know, a lot of words, not of maybe grand wisdom, but worked for me when I ran into tough spots and had to look back and ask how am I going to deal with this. I had a way. I didn't have a father, but I had a hell of a grandfather. So that's the last chapter in the book. There's an interesting chapter about the time that I met Al Stump. I can leave that to you guys, but if you want to hear me wax on about it, it was kind of fun and interesting. Cobb was really very, very desirous of having his story told. He had had a fascinating life. He had just an excellent memory and a lot of controversy. He was aggressive. He was competitive. He was the guy who stood on the top of the hill, proverbial hill, and would challenge anybody to come up and try and take him off that hill. If you look back, he was the highest paid baseball player in the majors from 1913 to 1920. Babe Ruth came along, the game changed, but 7 years of that, he won batting championships 12 times in the American League, and he just never backed down. He didn't back down personally, or he didn't back down from ball players or umpires. He took his licks. But anyway, when I went to college, that's what kids wanted to know about. And they didn't want to say, you had a nice grandfather, you're here. So I never talked much about it, but it served me well to remember the things that he imparted to me. So you want me to wax on about Al Stump? If you want, or you can just ask questions. I don't know how long we've been going.
That's fine. You can ask questions, but the first one should be this story.
Well, Stump was writing the book, and I should have brought it, but Stump was writing the book, and I was at my grandmother's house up early. She got up at 5 o'clock. She was a gardener, and I was in her kitchen early, and she fixed me some breakfast, and I asked if I could go visit Granddaddy, and she said, "That's way, way too early." She said, "Well, Herschel, your grandfather's probably asleep." And I said, "Well, call him up. So she did, and it was okay with him. So I went over there early, and there was another car in the driveway at his house in Atherton. He had a Spanish-style house, circular driveway, and the garage is set back there so you could park a car there. And it wasn't paved. The driveway wasn't paved. It was all those pebbles, so we could hear all this crunching, which is very memorable. Anyway, there was a blue sedan there, and I went in the house. And there was Granddaddy. He had his nightshirt on, but his gabardine slacks. He was unshaven. And Al Stump was there. And Al Stump had arrived early, purportedly to work on the book. And Granddaddy kind of introduced me. And Granddaddy and I are talking, and he's looking around to try and find Al Stump. And this is kind of how it began, before he introduced me to Al Stump. He says, "I want you to meet somebody." And he's looking around. He says, "Well, where is he? He said, "Granddaddy, there's a guy in your office," which you can see from where we were sitting. He said, "There's a guy in your office going through your file drawers." And Granddaddy turned around. I thought he was going to storm in and grab Stump, because I saw Stump, you know, lifting papers out and putting them into a manila folder. He yells at Stump to get out of his office and tell him, "You're not allowed in there. That's my office." And Stump comes out, and I get introduced. So Stump had this folder with whatever he put in it. So Granddaddy still hadn't shaven or anything like that, and his nurse came in and said, "Oh, Mr. Cobb, you need a shirt on. Your grandson is here. You have to look nice. And let me take you back help you clean up." So Granddaddy kind of acquiesced to this and went back to his room, and Stump immediately just looked at me like, "Oh my gosh, here's Herschel Cobb. He's 17 years old. I can ask him anything about his grandfather's risque life at Lake Tahoe." So he tried to pump me for, you know, 20, 25 minutes. So finally, and that was kind of funny, because I could just sense this guy was just not a pleasant guy. So Granddaddy comes in, and Stump begins to like get red in the face and say he has things to go, and he starts to leave the house, and he knocks on the door once he's left, comes back, says, "I forgot my folder." So I knew that folder had something in it that Stump really wanted. And so I rush over and said, "Is this what you're looking for, Mr. Stump?" And I hand the folder. Granddaddy intercepts it. He opens it up, and there's an autographed picture in it that Stump had wanted of Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth, and Tris Speaker. And a buddy of theirs, all in the same picture, all autographed. And they're grown men. It's at a game in Cleveland that Tris Speaker had invited them to. And Stump was on his way out the door then. And Granddaddy just was fuming. He was so caught, because Stump was his last chance to write his book. He was getting old. He couldn't start again. And he had picked somebody who was just no morals whatsoever. But anyway, so I described that fully in the book. So now we're at a point where questions?
Right. I'd like to first thank you. That was a great presentation of the book. And I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Herschel Cobb, the grandson of Ty Cobb, telling about his memoirs of his life with his grandfather in the book Heart of a Tiger. Now it's time for questions and answers. Who would like to ask the first question?
Yeah, we have baseball questions or personal questions or...
I just want to know, where'd you go to college?
Oh, I went to Occidental College in Los Angeles and then Berkeley for graduate school. Yeah. So,
I have a question about your grandfather's name, Ty. Is that his nickname or his... real name? Was it
Ty is a nickname from Tyrus. Tyrus is a city in Greece, has some history of bravery within the populace, and William Herschel Cobb, Ty's father, was a scholar, a professor, and had read about this and wanted to give his son a name that befitted somebody who was brave and could exceed at all odds and do well.
Well, that fits.
How do you explain at least what seemingly is an evolution in your grandfather, going from someone who was perceived by people who played baseball with him as someone who was so aggressive and difficult to someone that you knew as a young man and a young boy, and the difference between the perception and the reality you experienced?
Well, I don't think there's any question in my mind that as a baseball player and as a young man, he was fiercely competitive and intent on being the best. He wanted to be the best. And his competitive spirit was just, it was something in him that he found as a source of winning. The other thing is he was a very smart fellow and could maintain an aggressive stance and utilize what you and I would call, you know, you've got to get into the head of the other guy. He knew the value of fear. He also knew the value of poking at somebody in such a way that it upset their balance. Baseball is a game of inches, split seconds, and knowing that you can intimidate the other guy and that the other guy is never going to be sure as to what you're going to do. And so sometimes you do really, really radical things. Later in life, when he was my grandfather and I was spending time with him, first of all, a lot of time had passed. He had settled in California. He was over the age of 55, and he retired at the age of 42. So he matured a lot. I think that a lot of the descriptions of him are based upon Al Stump's characterizations of his ferocity. I wouldn't be surprised if there were other ball players of that genre or anywhere that are just as competitive and just as fierce, but I doubt if any of them get quite the notoriety because they don't have an Al Stump. Let me reflect on this just for a second. Is it Ty Cobb played in what you and I would call the early days of baseball? And in writing my book and in reading, because my publishers wanted me to know about my grandfather's history thoroughly because they thought maybe there was a baseball angle. I said, you know, I didn't see him play. But you have to think that he was the highest paid player for a reason. That was because more people came to ballparks to see him every game. Like, he gave me one of his personal scrapbooks. He made money and he had a scrapbook service. And when I read those sports reports about they're going to go play in Philadelphia, and to hear what the Philly fans are thinking about when Cobb is coming to play their team. You know, Cobb, last time he beat us with this, and this time we're going to stop him doing this. And he was a lightning rod for baseball. If you look through that area, that is the name that stands out way and above everybody else. And he used that to not only make a good living, but he used it. He's Ty Cobb. He's going to get to first. If he gets to first, he's going to get to second. If he gets to second, he's going to get to third. And that was acknowledged. Babe Ruth has some very, very interesting interviews about who was the greatest baseball player. And in short, Ruth says, well, it's got to be Ty Cobb, because if any pitcher, when I come to bat, if anybody doesn't want to deal with me, they just walk me. And once I get to first base, that's where I am. But think about it, with Ty Cobb, once he gets to first base, no matter how he gets there, whether it be a bunt or a walk or a hit, that's just the beginning of your problems, because he's going to go to second. You know it. It's just a matter of when. And then he's going to go to third. You know, he stole home 54 times in his life, in his career. 54 times. So, you know, he was acknowledged. If you go back, if you look on the internet, you can say, you know, back where the contemporaries were judging each other, who's the greatest? Well, you know, Cobb really rises, especially during that era. Cobb was very complimentary about Ruth. He had a great affection for Babe Ruth. They had a really great charity golf tournament. He knew Babe Ruth was sick. He visited him. They talked. He had a lot of sympathy for that man. But I think that ferocity, I don't think it was false. I think he truly was a fierce competitor. But I think that a lot of the characterizations or the exaggerations come from the movie and from Stump's book. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I was wondering if supposedly one of his worst enmities in his playing days was with Honus Wagner, and I was wondering if you had heard about that or he'd said anything about
that. Well, I have no personal knowledge of his relationship. They were in different leagues, for one thing, so they didn't play against each other much. So I don't know what relationship they had other than they competed in one World Series where Honus Wagner did quite well and Cobb did quite poorly. And that's about all I know in that vein, yeah. Although they have signatures going back and forth. Cobb was a great letter writer, and I run into that all the time. We live in Menlo Park, which is near Atherton. I run into people all the time and says, you know, I met somebody who has 10 or 12 of your grandfather's letters to him. You know, he loved to correspond by letters, and he always wrote his letters mostly in green ink, and that's how he did most of his signing of pictures and baseballs. Anything else that sounds fun to talk about? Next question. Yes?
I really liked hearing the story when Ty Cobb shared with you about how well he could hit a home run. Yeah.
Well, all right. Everybody knows that in 1920, Babe Ruth came on the scene and Major League Baseball tightened the wrapping on baseballs and made them harder, and fans went crazy for home runs. And that bothered my grandfather to no end because his style of baseball was you get one or two runs, and that was enough to win ball games. And those one run, two run, three run innings or wherever you got them were hard fought. That's why you get to first, you take second. But anyway, so there is a famous, and it's true that at one point Ty Cobb said, you know, hitting home runs is not as difficult as you all make it out to be, and tomorrow I'll show you. So the next day in the game, he hit three home runs, and the following day in the game, he hit two home runs. So he had five home runs in two games. That's been accomplished about half a dozen times in the history of baseball. And when he did that, like this gentleman was asking about the spacing, the 2 or 3 inches between hands that Cobb normally used, but he just put his hands together and got a lot more leverage. And he said, you know, that's all I'm going to do. I just showed you that it's not difficult to hit home runs. And then he went back to wanting people to really enjoy and appreciate what essentially is small ball getting on base. So, yes, sir.
You're describing him as being single-focused, wanting to be fast. Did he absolutely love the game more than, you know, anything else? And also, what in the 50s, what were the players that he liked or that he watched, or who were the people that he thought were really good?
Baseball was his life, and he loved it until the very end. Every summer at Lake Tahoe, we'd take a nap in the afternoon. We'd try and find a baseball game on the radio up in the mountains. The reception stinks. But, I was telling some gentlemen over here that I was a great Milwaukee Braves fan in 1956, 1957. And somewhere along the line, Ty Cobb had made a comment about that he had seen three or four perfect swings in baseball, and that Eddie Matthews had one. He played for the 57 Braves. And during the World Series, the Braves and the Yankees, my favorite team was the Braves, and the Yankees were playing. And I loved Warren Spahn and Hank Aaron and Lou Burdett and Wes Covington. And I like Reg Scandy, and she had one of those long names that I could pronounce easily. Del Crandall, and Frank Torrey was on that team, although I don't remember seeing him. Joe Adcock at first. And I remember in one of the World Series games getting Granddaddy on the phone, and we're kind of talking, and Hank Aaron comes up to play. He says, I said, Granddaddy, it's Hank Aaron. He's coming up to bat. He said, okay, Hirsch, now you watch his wrist. You watch his wrist. That man has the strongest wrist in baseball. You know, and Hank Aaron, if you ever saw him swing, he just snapped those wrists through the baseball, and home runs came. And he really admired Hank Aaron. He liked Eddie Matthews. Later on, in, I think it was 1959 or 60, he has a famously quoted as saying that Willie Mays is the only ball player today I'd pay money to go see. He really admired Willie Mays. And I'm sure he admired a lot. I mean, one of his best friends was Tris Speaker, and he was quick to say that he thought Tris Speaker was a much better center fielder than he was and had a better swing. And he wasn't ungracious with his compliments of other people.
So. Well, I have a question for you then.
Yes.
How did you become a Milwaukee Braves fan? I grew up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, right between Chicago and Milwaukee. And so Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews versus Ernie Banks of the Chicago Cubs,
yeah.
You know, they were all right around the same number of home runs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you were out here in California, weren't you?
Yeah.
So how did you pick
Milwaukee
Braves?
Well, we had TV, and I started watching, and obviously I liked Hank Aaron, but I also liked Warren Spahn. He was a lefty. He had that big grin. I don't know if anybody in the room knows Warren. He's the winningest left-hander in history, and his fastball was like 83, 84 miles an hour. And here comes a fastball, and today that's a changeup, you know, and yet nobody could hit it. And he had a good curve, and he was a big, goofy guy, and one of these high kicks, and I liked that, and I loved Reg Scandinch, and I saw a lot of neat double plays, and I don't know, it appealed to me.
They were popular locally, too.
Yeah.
No, everybody said they'll never go to Atlanta after they moved. No.
Yeah.
That's the last time we're ever going there. We'd like to ask, we have time for maybe two more questions. Anybody else have another question?
Somewhere I read that Cobb, when he was younger, was relatively racist, having come from the South, but that he mellowed and became a really ardent supporter of integration in Major League Baseball. Did he say anything about that, or can you comment on that?
Well, my experience with him is not as you suggest. I know that as a young boy in Narrows, Georgia, he told me that he and the Negro boy worked the plow in the fields together, and they got along. They both were in the same situation. He had working boots with no socks, and he had blue overalls. They had one fishing pole between them. He said they used to sneak off and catch fish and come back and do their rows. And he was from the Deep South, being born not too many years after the end of the Civil War, being brought up very sternly, very politely. Detroit was a northern city. It was quite different. And I think that he expected certain behavior of people. He's famously quoted while he was playing baseball with respect to Negroes that he thought they should be able to play baseball as long as everybody's behavior was satisfactory. I don't think he was a racist. I think that a lot of things are attributed to him because he was very, very visible. I don't doubt that he got into certain scuffles with people, but I don't think it was motivated by that. I think he got into scuffles with quite a lot of people. I think he had fights with ball players. I know he had fights with umpires. I know he was quite willing to take care of himself on the streets of Detroit. I think he was a very notable target on the streets of Detroit, and I don't think he was afraid to try and take care of himself. So. And I know for a fact in his later years, that doesn't exist because, you know, he created a very large educational fund in Georgia, and it is open to everybody. In 1953, I was at Tahoe when he was writing letters concerning his educational fund and wanting all the young boys and girls in Georgia to have scholarship money to go to school.
Who inspired Ty Cobb? How did he get into baseball?
How did he become so fierce? That's a speculation that we won't have. You know, he never answered it, but he was definitely in great admiration of his father. And he was a young man. Cobb was trying to make it as a professional baseball player, having left his home with his father's blessing, but his father's admonition to not come home a failure. So he went away. He's in the middle of his first year in Major League Baseball, 18 years old. There's an incident where his mother kills his father. You're aware of this? Yes. His mother shoots the father. The father thinks the mother is having some kind
That's a great last insight. Thank you very much, Herschel,
for your
book on your life. Thank you. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.